This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a game developer who wrote a new book on the gamification of our workplaces and schools and why it might be going too far. Now, a public health order that the Trump administration put in place, known as Title 42, was intended to limit illegal crossings at the U.S. border with Mexico during the pandemic. It was supposed to expire tomorrow after a court ruling. But after 19 Republican state attorneys general requested the U.S. Supreme Court step in, Chief Justice John Roberts announced yesterday that it would remain in place, at least temporarily. In anticipation of Title 42 going away, there have been reports of increases in asylum seekers traveling to the southern border. What happens now that the order is staying in effect is up in the air. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the status of America's immigration policy, especially when it comes to the southern border? Do you think Title 42 should remain in place? What would you like to see come out of all of this? Would you like to see Congress do something? If so, what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law, where he teaches and writes in the areas of local government law, immigration, and federalism. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Let's start with Title 42. What did it actually do? What is it actually doing right now?
Yeah, so it's an immigration law that is essentially dressed up as a public health measure. Mm-hmm. So the reason why it's useful as an immigration measure is because it essentially, or at least administrations have been using it to prevent people from applying for asylum. They should legally have a right to apply for asylum, but essentially through Title 42, they're excluding them without giving that opportunity. It's a public health measure, however, because it's not an immigration law. It's actually a law that is implemented to help prevent the introduction of a communicable disease, which is COVID. But that's the problem, because essentially the policy is based on not introducing COVID to the United States. But of course, that raises legal issues because it's not clear that it serves that purpose right now, given that COVID's already here and that the way we're implementing it doesn't really seem to be about COVID.
Let's talk about how applying for asylum works pre-Title 42 and under Title 42. If I'm coming up from, say, El Salvador, I want to cross the border. I could go to a legal point of entry or attempt to cross somewhere else. Either way, if and when I come into contact with authorities, I could then make an asylum request. What happens then under normal non-Title 42 policy?
Yeah, so under normal policy, they would first do a screening to just determine whether or not you may have a legitimate claim. But if they do determine that you may have a legitimate claim, you're scheduled for a hearing. And here's where some of the problems is arising, is that on the one hand, we can keep these people in detention, but we don't have a lot of detention capacity, especially when they're families with children. As a result, what's been going on is that we release some of them into the country to await essentially the court date, especially ones that we think will show up for the court date and will not pose a danger to the community. So as a result, people applying for asylum means that there's going to be more people awaiting their asylum adjudication and being released into the country.
Now, under Title 42, that same asylum seeker, if that's me, I show up at the border either place. What's happening under Title 42? I don't even get to make that request, right?
Yeah, so that's the way it's being used right now. And this is acknowledged that there are some legal questions about whether or not that's legitimate. Again, Title 42 is not an immigration measure. Under immigration law, you have a right to claim asylum. We may even have an international obligation to allow you to claim for asylum. But when it was implemented by the Trump administration and continued with the Biden administration, they've essentially interpreted this emergency health measure as essentially circumventing the ability to apply for asylum. So as a result, these individuals that are usually sent back to Mexico, though they're not willing to accept everyone that we send back, especially if they're Mexican, they're not Mexican nationals. But essentially, that's why it's become useful, is to essentially not allow them to apply for asylum to begin with.
Now, we keep seeing reports of large numbers of people today waiting across the border, hoping this Title 42 policy changes. It was scheduled to end on tomorrow. What's accounting for this large number? Is this pent-up demand, people who have been coming and being rejected, people who are waiting, pending the policy? What's going on?
Yeah, so one of it is pent-up demand, right? Because of Title 42, a lot of people have been sent back, but then they try to cross over and over and over again, right? Because the longer, especially if you can try to sneak in and stay, then hopefully they won't be able to exclude you with Title 42 and you can apply for asylum. So some of that is just people that have been there, right? Looking to come in all sorts of different circumstances. But there's also another sort of interesting thing going on, which is we tend to forget that these people applying for asylum, the countries are changing, right? So now it's mostly Haiti, it's Venezuela, even the countries that we talked about before are different. So it seems like there's just a lot of instability in the countries in the Southern Hemisphere, and that's also causing, I think, a lot of people to seek admission into the country, partly because they're being pushed out by different forces in their home country.
Talking to Rick Hsu, immigration expert at the University of North Carolina School of Law, looking at this federal policy, again, a health policy that's been used as an immigration policy at the U.S.-Mexico border, supposed to end tomorrow. Now that's bumped back. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, what you think of this policy, whether you want to see it end, if there's a better way you think to handle how we handle immigration at the southern border. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Rick, when we called you originally, we're going to talk about this policy that's about to expire. Since we called you, Supreme Court says, hang on, we're putting this on hold. Biden administration report in by Tuesday, today afternoon. Where are we right now?
Yeah, right now we're up to the Supreme Court. And this is acknowledged that getting up to this point, it's been a roller coaster, right? We had a court in Louisiana that essentially said that the Biden administration cannot get rid of Title 42. Then we had a court in District of Columbia, DC Circuit, that essentially said you had to get rid of Title 42. And of course, that was coming up with the 21st as the date that it had to be eliminated because the court ruled that it was outside their power. This is not really about public health. And then the Supreme Court stepped in. Now, the Supreme Court has put a stay, and they've said that they wanted to essentially consider the arguments that are being made. Though it's not entirely clear exactly what argument that they're looking at, whether it's exactly the substance of Title 42. The more technical question, which is whether or not these Republican states can actually intervene in this litigation, they weren't part of the original litigation. The litigation was essentially individuals suing the federal government. So they want to come in and essentially defend Title 42, even though they're not the federal government. So that was actually rejected by the court. So it could be that the court's focusing on that technical question, whether they can even enter into the lawsuit. Or maybe they'll go all the way and decide that they're actually going to decide the substantive issue, which is whether or not this is going beyond the federal government, or more specifically, the CDC's authority to use this as an immigration measure.
And the court has been hostile in some past cases to CDC, to the federal government's claims to have public safety emergency powers when it comes to COVID. So if they look at this as a health rule, that might lead them one way. If they look at this as an immigration rule in practice, could that lead them in a different direction?
Oh, definitely. And I think this is precisely, I think, what a lot of people are looking to the court right now, which is, are they going to stick with precedent and principles, or is politics going to intrude? Certainly, this court has not been very generous with regard to CDC measures specifically. They have not been generous with regard to agency power. They recently actually read the statute to limit the EPA's powers. Following that, it would seem they would be quite cautious of, again, the CDC overstepping its bounds in this particular case. But then again, there's a lot of political forces here that is pushing for Title 42. It's become so useful and is a way of sort of skirting the need for sort of congressional action on this, that pressure might be enough for them to come up with some sort of precedent saying that this is really still all about COVID.
On a practical level, if Title 42 ended, if not tomorrow, then soon, there's a lot of people waiting to come and make asylum claims, and maybe not enough staff to deal with those claims and judges to deal with those claims and enforcement to look at the places where people aren't supposed to be crossing. Is there a serious logistical concern that the system can't handle the number of people who would be seeking asylum?
Yeah, there's definitely a logistical concern, but this is acknowledged that this is not new. In some ways, we've been enabled to accommodate the number of people seeking asylum for. almost a decade at this point. So these are not new problems. The fact that we don't have enough capacity, the fact that we don't go through these claims fast enough, the fact that we don't have enough resources, right? And of course, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, is asking for more resources with regard to this. And it could be that we need legal change, right, with regard to how we do asylum claims. But this is not new, but it will certainly continue and be a problem. Title 42 is a Band-Aid, but maybe it's time to actually look at the actual problem underlying it.
Talking to Rick Hsu, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. And we're talking about the, at least for now, temporary extension of Title 42, a health policy with big immigration implications, what it means for asylum seekers coming to the U.S. border with Mexico. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're confused by all of this, I promise you are not alone. Do you have a question for a guest about how this works, what it all means? What concerns do you have about what's going on at the U.S. border with Mexico? What do you want to see from the president, the courts, and hey, how about Congress? We'll talk about them in just a bit. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with immigration law expert Rick Hsu from the University of North Carolina School of Law, talking about a public health measure, Title 42, from the Trump administration that was used to turn away asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without a hearing. It was set to expire tomorrow under a previous court ruling before the U.S. Supreme Court announced a temporary extension yesterday. You can join in with your questions, your reactions, your hopes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. This is great because it has been a bit of a conundrum. And, you know, it seems to me that the health aspect needs to be taken aside and apart from the immigration section, because what it's doing, it's just something that's thrown in there to legitimize just keeping as many people out as we can. And it seems that the very first thing that should be done to anyone coming into the country that's going to live here is they need to have pass a medical. I mean, to me, that's very, very legitimate and very practical. Yeah, it has to be paid for, but we're paying a lot into the immigration problem now anyway. Let's put it towards something positive. If they don't pass the medical, then they have a legitimate reason for sending the people back. But if they pass the medical, it seems to me even an interview.
We lost you there, Anita, but I think we catch your point. Anita saying, hey, if this is a health measure, let's start with health checks instead of this blanket block.
Yeah, so that's actually a really good point, because that's precisely actually what the court had held in the D.C. Circuit when they approached this as a health measure, right? Because no one's talking about this as a health measure except in court. And the court said, if it's really about a health measure, then shouldn't there be other ways of dealing with it? If we're worried about people coming in with COVID, then we can do a COVID rapid test. We can give them vaccinations. We can even quarantine them, right, if that's what we're really concerned about. So in some ways, the court was saying that partly to suggest that maybe the government is saying it's a public health measure, but it's not. But certainly that would be a possibility. If we really are concerned about COVID and these people having COVID, then that should be part of the processing itself. Now, of course, there are still more logistical problems, but I think at least the health side is the least of the logistical problems here. But that's absolutely correct. That was what the court had noted, if the government was really interested in this as a health measure.
Anita, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rick, we're talking about the White House doing these things. Title 42 came from the CDC and effectively an executive branch decision here. We're talking about the courts. I remember civics class. There's another part of government called Congress. What are they doing and I guess not doing that's part of this problem?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Before, we always had some sort of, there was a pattern we had, an immigration compromise of some sort every 10 years. And of course, that entirely broke down. And it's been decades since we've had any massive sort of immigration law addressing it. I think the problem here is it's politics. It's not clear at the end of the day, as much as there is a problem, and the problem keeps growing, that there's a lot of political will to actually solve the problem. And not because there's not enough political support to do so. I think there's a lot of political support for various positions. I think there's now a lot of political gain to create or maintain the problem. So I feel like that's kind of the complication going into this. I think there are things that Congress can do and that Congress may want to do, but a lot of people feel there's a lot of political points, and I say on both sides, to sort of keep the immigration issue live and live in a particular way. There's too many live wires here, I think people are afraid to touch.
There was talk of a bipartisan compromise maybe in the works in this current lame duck session. DACA recognition, the deferred A for childhood arrivals. I can't remember all the letters of that.
Yeah.
Remain in Mexico policy, border security funding, things like that. And that seems to have dissolved.
Yeah, well, it doesn't. So the one thing that's really interesting that DACA, right, deferred action for childhood arrival. Actually, right, Dreamers, right, in this particular regard, is in the mix is because that is one area where, at least in terms of polling, it's very popular, right? A lot of people support Dreamers, don't want to see them deported. But I think the issue here is the issue with DACA and the Dreamers is what are we going to trade that for? And I think in some ways, the Republicans are willing to, I think, grant something to Dreamers at some point, but they want to trade something big for it. So it's not clear that this is what it is. Not to mention, the original deal was about extending Title 42, but that has to deal with the fact that Title 42 is a health measure. If they were really going in to sort of change immigration law, that would be a different compromise. But then you got to deal with asylum. And asylum, of course, is connected to international obligations. So essentially, I think what may be on the table is a lot more complicated than just the politics itself as well, because it involves all sorts of different moving parts. This is not something that could be thrown together last minute, unfortunately.
Talking to Rick Hsu with University of North Carolina School of Law, immigration law expert there, looking at this Title 42 on hold right now, still in existence, a health law, as we heard, used as an immigration enforcement measure. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Rick, earlier you mentioned countries of origin for people showing up at the border, changing Venezuela, Haiti, among the countries. Talk that the Biden administration now may try to figure out a way to say, hey, you can apply for asylum without showing up at the border. Do it from your home country. Don't undertake this dangerous journey. What is potentially in the works there?
Yeah, so that has actually been talked about for a while. And this idea is that we would essentially have them be able to apply for asylum in their country of origin. And we can make a decision without them having to either wait at the border or wait in detention in the United States or be released into the country. This is, however, quite difficult, right? I mean, there's a lot of challenges because you have to negotiate with those countries to allow you, allow us to do that kind of processing, which also means that in some ways these are individuals that have some sort of grievance against the very country that we're asking for permission to address these grievances. Not to mention, I think one thing that was interesting when it was originally proposed, we thought that this issue was isolated to essentially the three countries in Central America. Mm-hmm. But now it's spreading. So even if we adopt something like this, it feels like the country of origin just keeps changing, partly because there's just so much instability in the world. So even if we set it up, it may be that by the time we set it up, there's going to be another country, another area, another region that is now going to be the cause for asylum applications. So it may be that alongside that, we may just have to deal with the fact that, deal with the instability in our region, that we should be more cognizant and trying to stabilize the region as well, as much as we focus on different parts of the country, the world.
So the current reality is people are showing up at the border. They're not allowed to apply for asylum. What's the reality now for people in that position?
Yeah, so a lot of them are sent back to Mexico, and this goes along with the Remain in Mexico program, which also does the same. Mexico is not very happy with this, and there are many foreign nationals that they're not willing to take back. So Title 42, Remain Mexico, essentially depends on the cooperation of Mexico. Most of these cases, we're not talking about Mexican nationals anymore. And Mexico, I think, is frustrated at this. So there's foreign affairs concerns implicated in all of this. Not to mention, when they're in Mexico, it's essentially a refugee situation. It's almost like refugee camps there. And those are not necessarily safe. In fact, they're probably worse than some other refugee situations where the UN is involved in this particular case. So they're not in a good situation either with regard to that. So in some ways, it's not good for the countries that are like Mexico, and it's not good for the immigrants who are seeking asylum.
Time for one more caller. John is with us in St. Croix County. John, hi.
Hey, yeah. I guess my question is, with this whole immigration thing going and the borders being so porous, these people are coming across, and who's paying to feed them? Who's putting them up? And there's so many people. I'm curious, how much of this tax, you know, we're paying all these taxes all the time, property taxes.
John, just a minute or so left, but Rick, I mean, if somebody's being detained, then I think the U.S. government's picking up the dime. If they're finding employment illegally, then they're paying into the system in some ways.
That's right. So essentially, what's going on in this situation and why you're hearing a lot of the concerns is not just coming from the federal government, but coming from local government and aid agencies. Is once they get applied for asylum and they're released into the country, the federal government's not responsible for aiding them at all. If they have family members, that's great. But a lot of that falls on actually local governments and falls on the sort of hands of local aid agencies. So there could be some complaints that the federal government's actually not doing enough. Though, of course, that is also politically fraught in this particular situation, as you noted with taxes. One thing to note is that all the focus right now is on border enforcement, but these are not people sneaking across the border. These are people presenting themselves to U.S. border agents. So in some ways, we need resources, but it's not necessarily in enforcement. We actually have pretty robust borders right now with regard to detection, and these people are not trying to sneak through. But we may need more resources, or at least coordinate some way of thinking about who's going to actually pay for these individuals when they need assistance. But this is acknowledged that most of them often have family members, or they are able to find employment awaiting their asylum adjudication.
John, thanks for that call. And Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rick Hsu, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. We talked to him today about the temporary extension of a Trump-era measure that prevented asylum seekers from getting a hearing at the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a COVID-era health policy, but big in the immigration issue. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, save money on your energy bills with some advice on energy conservation in the winter months. Join in with your own questions and maybe your own advice for others. Join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Kids of different generations may have grown up with fond memories of the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial, and the kindly alien creature who starred in it. Now one lucky and wealthy fan owns E.T., or at least E.T.'s skeleton. As reported by the Washington Post, an auction house accepted a winning bid of $2.5 million for the mechatronic filming model used in the making of the movie E.T. It's the actual moving model they used in filming, a unique contraption that allowed a kind of advanced puppeteering and had 85 points of articulation where the model could move. Good news for the owner, apparently it still works. Bad news, the outer layer, the skin, has disintegrated over the years. So from the pictures I've seen, it's kind of more of a horror movie special effect these days. Guess you get what you pay for. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, games are supposed to be fun, but more and more we're seeing aspects of games used in some of the less fun parts of our lives, like work or school or exercise, our finances. And unlike games that are fun, if you lose at these kinds of games, you can face real-world consequences, and you can't just insert another quarter to try again. The idea of gamification has been on the rise since the early 2000s, and our next guest thinks it has positive uses, but it often goes too far. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see examples of gamification in your life? Do you use some kind of app, a language or exercise or something like that that gives you points or rewards streaks or sets you up against other people? How about your workplace? Or have you seen this in a school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've encountered this, tell us what you think about it, if it motivates you. Adrian Hahn is the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start, creators of the popular mobile fitness app Zombies Run. He's the author of the new book, You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. Adrian, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Can you start off with sort of a working definition of gamification? What does it mean?
Yeah, it's basically the use of ideas from game design, like points, badges, leaderboards, missions, that sort of thing, for non-game purposes. So for things like education, health, fitness, anything that isn't just about entertainment.
A lot of your book and a lot of our conversation are going to be about the misuse and abuse of gamification. But you don't think it's necessarily bad in and of itself? You use it, for example, in apps you've created. At best, what can gamification help us do?
Well, I think that gamification can help us achieve things that we know we should be doing or we really want to do, like learn a language or, you know, get fit or just learn new concepts. But we find it kind of difficult to do so or really tough. So I think one really fun game out there is called Kerbal Space Program. And it's all about learning physics and orbital mechanics by launching little creatures into space. And it's very accurate. And it's just a great way of learning science. But also, I think there's all sorts of fitness games. You know, a lot of people play Nintendo's Ring Fit Adventure. I used to play Dance Dance Revolution, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, a lot of ways to make boring activities a bit more fun.
Now, let's stay with those self-improvement apps. I find, you know, I've got a fitness tracker. It gets me out going for walks. I do a language one. It keeps me motivated to keep my streak going to learn a language. That's great. But you say sometimes gamification is misused in those self-improvement apps for a variety of reasons. Where do we start to go wrong with those?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned streaks, because I think that's a really powerful motivator for a lot of players. So, you know, a lot of people use Peloton, a lot of people have Apple Watches, and a lot of these are fitness apps and games use streaks to encourage people to work out, you know, 5 days in a row, 10 days in a row, 100 days in a row. You know, you see people showing off their streaks and trying to maintain them even at the expense of their own health. You know, we know that it's not healthy to be exercising when you're ill. Even if you're not ill, it's just good to have rest days when you're running or swimming or cycling. And these streaks, you know, if they're designed in a really simple way, which is how most of them are, if they give people achievements for just working out forever and not taking any rest, they can actually harm you. And that's one example of gamification that is against people's interests.
Talking to Adrian Hahn, his new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use one of these motivational apps that uses leaderboards or streaks, say, or points to reward you and motivate you? Did you stop? If so, why? And how about at your workplace? Are there competitions, productivity challenges, things like that? What do you think about those? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. Adrian, let's go to work now. You spend a lot of time looking at how companies are gamifying for better and mostly for worse. First of all, what kind of things are out there if people haven't encountered this at work?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's all over the place. I was amazed and kind of disturbed by how frequent it is. So a lot of people work in call centers now or in customer support, and their interactions with customers are timed down to the second. And if they are not acting well, or if they're not, you know, being polite enough or just responding quickly enough, then they can have points deducted and they can slip down the leaderboard and not receive achievements. And if they do too badly in this kind of gamified system, then of course they can get punished and get fired. But I think one place which people will be pretty familiar with, one app, is Uber. And a lot of Uber drivers are having their compensation effectively gamified. So periodically, Uber drivers will be invited to choose from different quests. And in these quests, they can sign up to drive 30, you know, 70, 100 trips in a week. And if they achieve the quest, then they get more money. And if they don't, then they lose that. And of course, you could say, well, isn't that a good thing? You know, people like having more money. But if you talk to Uber drivers, which I've done and a lot of people have done, they find it kind of manipulative because at the end of the day, it's all down to money. And I think they'd rather have more certainty rather than having to hope that they'll be offered these quests and hope that they can really achieve those goals. I think what they'd rather have is just better pay in general. And it's really interesting that they choose to call these things quests, you know, rather than just tasks. And I think part of that is down to the fact that we're all used to thinking that quests and challenges and achievements are good things because we play video games. Everyone plays video games now. And it's really interesting and kind of a bit disturbing to see workplaces take those ideas from video games and try and use them in a way that can exploit people, I think.
Well, and you talk about what ends up being incentivized in that Uber driver's case, and then this can come up with certain truck driver systems too, the incentive might be keep driving, even though you might feel too tired to keep driving. Ultimately, the incentives can lead us in potentially dangerous directions.
Well, exactly. I mean, I you know, people from Uber are on record for saying that they want drivers to drive as much as possible. Obviously, they would say that they don't want people to drive dangerously. At the same time, you know, it's not just quests that Uber uses to try and manipulate people. There's all sorts of things, that, tricks in the apps, gamification they use to try and get people to move to different areas of the city or just to drive more. And, you know, I think that these systems can work in incentivizing people through money or just through visuals to try and get them to do more than they wanted to.
Now, you also look at use of these apps in schools, and I'll get to one of those in a minute, but one of the most amazing quotes from your book is a New York Times article about a classroom game app called Class Dojo. A third grader quoting here, "I like it because you get rewarded for your good behavior, like a dog does when it gets a treat." I mean, that third grade kid, I mean, he says a lot there.
Yes, this was one of the most eye-opening things I discovered while researching the book. This comes from an app called Class Dojo, which is used in supposedly 95% of US schools, and it's in schools around the world. And it basically does two things. The first thing is pretty simple. It's like a private social network for teachers, students, and parents, and that's fine. But the second thing is basically, it's an app that gives teachers the ability to reward and deduct points from all the students in their class in real time. So they can go and say, oh, if this kid is acting up or being too noisy, minus 10 points. If they're being quiet, if they are doing teamwork, then plus 20 points. And those points can often be traded in for treats. And again, you know, this is not a new thing. We've had points and we've had badges in schools before. But as that kid says, you know, there is something about the kind of continuous nature and also about the way in which this app works just from an audio point of view, which is really interesting and really different. So in Class Dojo, when you get points deducted, you hear the sad sound from the phone, from the teacher's phone. If you get points awarded, you get this happy sound. And, you know, the kids obviously associate that, you know, with being trained like a dog. And now, of course, you could say, well, this is good if it keeps the classroom under control. But really, is this the way that we want kids to learn in school, to be motivated in school? And I think that's a big question. Some people might say, actually, that's fine as long as kids behave. But I'm sure that a lot of parents would think otherwise.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Racine. Peter, what did you want to tell us about?
So I actually work as a software developer for a manufacturing company, and we use scoreboards like this, the gamification, to motivate workers and to try and, you know, have them work off of each other. It isn't used to alter their pay or anything like that. It's just used to evaluate and address issues where performance does fall or where performance is exceptional. It's one of those things where, in my opinion at least, it's all about the ethics of how it's implemented. You don't want to do exactly what Uber's doing and encourage bad behavior or discourage good behavior because of the way your algorithms report on performance. But it can be used very constructively, at least in my experience.
And Peter, can I ask, how long has this been in place at your workplace?
Some of the scoreboards have been in place for 8 to 10 years now, and some of them we are implementing. It just, you know, every time we find a place where we can utilize it, it's great, but you have to be able to compare people on very even terms, and when you have different roles that don't mesh with each other, it's very hard to compare them.
Interesting. Peter, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Adrian, what do you think of Peter's example?
Well, I think it's really interesting because we've always had examples of giving feedback to workers in workplaces. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, people want to know when they're doing well and when they're doing poorly. And it can be nice having that feedback in real time. I think it really depends on scale. You know, it's hard for me to know whether one case or another case is done well. Certainly in some big organizations, one of the problems that we have with these gamified workplaces is that the only way you get feedback is through this computerized system, this gamified system, and there is no way really to talk to a manager. And it is being done in such a kind of fine-grained surveillance way that even if you slip up once, then that's it. And so that's obviously, I think most people would agree, that's just too cruel. Now, I think there are ways to do this in a way that isn't that doesn't punish people so much. But it really comes down to those rewards and punishments. You know, if the punishment for slipping up a couple of times is you're fired or you're docked pay, then, you know, that's too much. But if it's just, hey, we're going to have a chat, then that's probably okay.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Peter. We're talking to game designer Adrian Hahn about his new book on gamification. It's called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, like Peter, have something like this going on at your workplace? What do you think about it? How about in your school or your child's school? Have you used Class Dojo or some other behavior reward app like that? What do you think about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Adrian Hahn, founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. His new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your encounters with streaks or points or leaderboards at your work, your school, your exercise app, you name it, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kevin is on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm a teacher. I have used these points-based systems with students on multiple occasions. Honestly, I do not like them. I think they are teaching kids the wrong idea of doing things for points or for not losing points. And until they internalize that this positive effort leads to positive consequence, they're a very poor crutch. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for sharing that. Adrian, that gets to the heart of a big question here for students and others. What is our motivation? What should our motivation be for doing something like behaving and learning in school?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, he's drawing a distinction between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, you know, where extrinsic motivation would be just trying to get someone to do something by effectively, you know, bribing or rewarding them with sweets or points or trinkets. And, intrinsic motivation, is where we want kids to learn English or learn science because they find it interesting, or they find it, engaging, or they find it, beautiful. And of course, it's not always the case that kids are going to pick up on that immediately. And it's difficult to do that if you've got, a huge class and you don't have a lot of time to prepare. So I do sympathize, with teachers who do, end up using ClassDojo. I think a lot of them probably would prefer not to. And I think it's a weird situation where I think some kids and some parents actually expect ClassDojo to be used in some places. But, the problem is if you rely on it too much, then the only thing that the kids are trying to do is maximize points. And, that only works for so long.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Wendy joins us now in New Berlin. Wendy, hi.
Hello, Kevin. You just summed up exactly how I feel. I'm a retired teacher, and I got my degree in the 70s, and I think that makes a difference. So I found so many teachers doing these money programs or tokens, and I didn't do it. In fact, I fought against it by doing things like I would bring in a whole tray of chocolate chip cookies. And my students would be like, whoa, what'd we do? And I'd say nothing. I just like you. And that was hard for them to get. I think it's really seriously a problem. It's scary to me how children are being manipulated. And it is much easier for the teacher, but good luck trying to break that system.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Well, for somebody like Wendy at a school, making decisions at a workplace, you name it, how do you break out of that gamification, negative gamification mentality, Adrian?
I think it's tricky because obviously, if you're just one teacher in a school and you've got, a lot of obligations, it's hard to sort of swim against the tide. Especially, of course, if you're a worker in, Amazon, or if you're a driver at Uber, maybe you don't have a lot of power there. I think as individuals, then, we can try and push back against gamification when we encounter it in our own lives and just be aware of when we're being gamified. I mean, to take, for example, I've got an Apple Watch, and every month it tells me to try and beat my previous month's calorie goal. which is, as you can imagine, it gets increasingly difficult to do that to a point where it's impossible. And it's okay to just turn that off, right? If you see that in your life, if you have an app like Duolingo or you have a watch that says, hey, please try and do more, you can just turn that off because that's not something that you're asking for. I think in schools, I love that note by Wendy talking about just, hey, I'm just giving you these cookies because I like you, rather than, it's a reward or a punishment. And that's something I try to do in my own workplace, with my employees. I think people like getting positive feedback and they like getting, learning about ways to improve. At the same time, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm just doling out points and badges every, few minutes or every hour, as actually happens in some workplaces now. So, if you're in a position of influence, then you can try and change things. If you're just someone who, if you're someone who works at a workplace, then you can ask them to change. But in your own life, I think there are places you can turn off gamification if you can.
Wendy, thanks for that call. I also accept chocolate chip cookies, if you like the show. Adrian, you're pitching messages to different audiences here. I want to focus on one: people who design apps and programs and workplace reward systems. What kind of ethical considerations do you want those people to have in mind as they design and then implement these kind of gamified setups?
Well, I have a few different sort of like guidelines for how people can do it well. One guideline that I've mentioned before is really try and keep the rewards and punishments small, right? It's just not, it's not a good system if the punishment is you're fired or you're fined $10,000. It just makes people terrified. to be honest, it's not really a good motivator. And similarly, if you have a prize of $1 million, $10,000 or free college, or that sort of thing, as the result of performing well in a gamified system. But people are just going to manipulate that. They're going to burn themselves out. They're going to cheat. It's not a way to motivate desirable behavior. I think another thing to do when designing these systems is ultimately to try and keep the customer or the players or the users' best interests at heart. And that is very hard to do. And sometimes, you know, people might say that's paternalist, but, you know, that's something that we just try to do in our own games. We try to think, look, how can we design this in a way that people are not going to be unhappy at us for making them overexercise or unhappy at us at spending more money than they wanted to? And sometimes that can go against the profit motive. And that's just something you're going to have to decide. And not every designer can make that decision, but you can voice your opposition.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Adrian Hahn. His new book is called You've Been Played: How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at Hallmark and Lifetime holiday movies. Love them or hate them, we'll talk about them tomorrow on Central Time.